spit them on the floor. Chapter 21 Dawn in Chicago. Heavy air and the gray sky low. A security guard came out of the lobby of the Tatler building and stood at the curb smoking a cigarette and rubbing the small of his back. He was alone on the street, and in the quiet he could hear the clack of the traffic light changing at the top of the hill, a long block away. Half a block north of the light, out of the guard's sight, Francis Dollarhide squatted beside Lowndes in the back of the van. He arranged the blanket in a deep cowl that hid Lowndes' head. Lowndes was in great pain. He appeared stuporous, but his mind was racing. There were things he must remember. The blindfold was tented across his nose, and he could see Dollarhide's fingers checking the crusted gag. Dollarhide put on the white jacket of a medical orderly, laid a thermos in Lowndes' lap, and rolled him out of the van. When he locked the wheels of the chair and turned to put the ramp back in the van, Lowndes could see the end of the van's bumper beneath his blindfold. Turning now, seeing the bumper guard. Yes, the license plate. Only a flash, but Lowndes burned it into his mind. Rolling now, sidewalk seams, around a corner and down a curb. Paper crackled under the wheels. Dollarhide stopped the wheelchair in a bit of littered shelter between a garbage dumpster and a parked truck. He pulled at the blindfold. Lowndes closed his eyes, an ammonia bottle under his nose. The soft voice, close beside him. "Can you hear me? You're almost there." The blindfold off now. "Blink if you can hear me." Dollarhide opened his eye with a thumb and forefinger. Lowndes was looking at Dollarhide's face. "I told you one fib," Dollarhide tapped the thermos. "I don't really have your lips on ice." He whipped off the blanket and opened the thermos. Lowndes strained hard when he smelled the gasoline, separating the skin from under his forearms and making the stout chair groan. The gas was cold all over him, fumes filling his throat, and they were rolling toward the center of the street. "Do you like being Graham's pet, Freedy?" Lit with a whump and shoved, sent rolling down on the Tatler. "Eek, eek, eek," the wheels. The guard looked up as a scream blew the burning gag away. He saw the fireball coming, bouncing on the potholes, trailing smoke and sparks, and the flames blown back like wings, disjointed reflections leaping along the shop windows. It veered, struck a parked car, and overturned in front of the building, one wheel spinning and flames through the spokes, blazing arms rising in the fighting posture of the burned. The guard ran back into the lobby. He wondered if it would blow up, if he should get away from the windows. He pulled the fire alarm. What else? He grabbed the fire extinguisher off the wall and looked outside. It hadn't blown up yet. The guard approached cautiously through the greasy smoke spreading low over the pavement and, at last, sprayed foam on Freddy Lowndes. Chapter 22 The schedule called for Graham to leave the staked-out apartment in Washington at 5:45 a.m., well ahead of the morning rush. Crawford called while he was shaving. "Good morning." "Not so good," Crawford said. "The Tooth Fairy got Lowndes in Chicago." "Oh, hell no." "He's not dead yet, and he's asking for you. He can't wait long." "I'll go." "Meet me at the airport, United 245. It leaves in 40 minutes. You can be back for the stakeout if it's still on." Special Agent Chester from the Chicago FBI office met them at O'Hare in a downpour. Chicago is a city used to sirens. The traffic parted reluctantly in front of them as Chester howled down the expressway, his red light flashing pink on the driving rain. He raised his voice above the siren. Chicago PD says he was jumped in his garage. My stuff is secondhand. We're not popular around here today. How much is out? Crawford said. The whole thing. Trap. All of it. Did Lowndes get a look at him? I haven't heard a description. Chicago PD put out an all-points bulletin for a license number about 620. Did you get hold of Dr. Bloom for me? I got his wife, Jack. Dr. Bloom had his gallbladder taken out this morning. Glorious, Crawford said. Chester pulled under the dripping hospital portico. He turned in his seat. Jack, Will, before you go up, I hear this fruit really trashed Lowndes. You ought to be ready for that. Graham nodded. All the way to Chicago he had tried to choke his hope that Lowndes would die before he had to see him. The corridor of Page Burn Center was a tube of spotless tile. A tall doctor with a curiously old young face beckoned Graham and Crawford away from the knot of people at Lowndes' door. "Mr. Lowndes' burns are fatal," the doctor said. "I can help him with the pain, and I intend to do it. He breathed flames, and his throat and lungs are damaged. He may not regain consciousness. In his condition, that would be a blessing. In the event that he does regain consciousness, the city police have asked me to take the airway out of his throat so that he might possibly answer questions. I've agreed to try that, briefly. At the moment, his nerve endings are anesthetized by fire. A lot of pain is coming, if he lives that long. I made this clear to the police, and I want to make it clear to you. I'll interrupt any attempted questioning to sedate him if he wants me to. Do you understand me? Yes, Crawford said. With a nod to the patrolman in front of the door, the doctor clasped his hands behind his white lab coat and moved away like a wading egret. Crawford glanced at Graham. You okay?
I'm okay.
I had the SWAT team. Lowndes' head was elevated in the bed. His hair and ears were gone, and compresses over his sightless eyes replaced the burned-off lids. His gums were puffed with blisters. The nurse beside him moved an IV stand so Graham could come close. Lowndes smelled like a stable fire. Freddy, it's Will Graham. Lowndes arched his neck against the pillow. The movement's just reflex. He's not conscious, the nurse said. The plastic airway holding open his scorched and swollen throat hissed in time with the respirator. A pale detective sergeant sat in the corner with a tape recorder and a clipboard on his lap. Graham didn't notice him until he spoke. Lowndes said your name in the emergency room before they put the airway in. You were there? Later I was there, but I've got what he said on tape. He gave the fireman a license number when they first got to him. He passed out, and he was out in the ambulance, but he came around for a minute in the emergency room when they gave him a shot in the chest. Some Tatler people had followed the ambulance. They were there. I have a copy of their tape. Let me hear it. The detective fiddled with his tape recorder. I think you want to use the earphone, he said, his face carefully blank. He pushed the button. Graham heard voices, the rattle of casters. Put him in there. The bump of a litter on a swinging door, a retching cough, and a voice croaking, speaking without lips.
Tooth, Harry.
Freddy, did you see him? What did he look like, Freddy?
Wendy, please, Wendy. Graham set me up. The cunt knew it. Graham set me up. Cunt took his hand on me in the picture like a fucking tent. Wendy.
A noise like a drain sucking. A doctor's voice. That's it. Let me get there. Get out of the way. Now. That was all. Graham stood over Lowndes while Crawford listened to the tape. We're running down the license number, the detective said. Could you understand what he was saying? Who's Wendy? Crawford asked. That hooker in the hall, the blonde, with the chest. She's been trying to see him. She doesn't know anything. Why don't you let her in? Graham said from the bedside. His back was to them. No visitors.
The man's dying. Think I don't know it? I've been here since a quarter to fucking 6 o'clock. Excuse me, nurse?
Take a few minutes, Crawford said. Get some coffee. Put some water on your face. He can't say anything. If he does, I'll be here with the recorder.
Okay, I could use it.
When the detective was gone, Graham left Crawford at the bedside and approached the woman in the hall.
Wendy?
Yeah?
If you're sure you want to go in there, I'll take you.
I want to. Maybe I ought to go comb my hair?
It doesn't matter, Graham said. When the policeman returned, he didn't try to put her out. Wendy of Wendy City held Lowndes's blackened claw and looked straight at him. He stirred once, a little before noon.
"It's going to be just fine, Roscoe," she said. "We'll have us some high old times."
Lowndes stirred again and died. Chapter 23. Captain Osborne of Chicago Homicide had the gray, pointed face of a stone fox. Copies of the Tatler were all over the police station. One was on his desk. He didn't ask Crawford and Graham to sit down.
"You had nothing at all working with Lowndes in the city of Chicago?"
"No, he was coming to Washington," Crawford said. "He had a plane reservation. I'm sure you've checked it."
"Yeah, I got it. He left his office about 1:30 yesterday, got jumped in the garage of his building. Must have been about 2:10.
"Anything in the garage?"
"His keys got kicked under his car. There's no garage attendant. They had a radio-operated door, but it came down on a couple of cars and they took it out. So nobody saw it happen. That's getting to be the refrain today. We're working on his car.
Can we help you there?"
"You can have the results when I get them."
"You haven't said much, Graham. You had plenty to say in the paper."
"I haven't heard much either, listening to you."
"You pissed off, Captain?" Crawford said.
"Me? Why should I be? We run down a phone trace for you and collar a fucking news reporter. Then you've got no charges against him. You have got some deal with him, gets him cooked in front of this scandal sheet. Now the other papers adopt him like he was their own. Now we've got our own Tooth Fairy murder right here in Chicago. That's great. Tooth Fairy in Chicago, boy. Before midnight, we'll have 6 accidental domestic shootings. Guy trying to sneak in his own house, drunk. Wife hears him. Bang. The Tooth Fairy may like Chicago, decide to stay around, have some fun."
"We can do like this," Crawford said. "Butt heads. Get the police commissioner and the U.S. attorney all stirred up. Get all the assholes stirred up, yours and mine. Or we can settle down and try to catch the bastard. This was my operation and it went to shit. I know that.
You ever have that happen right here in Chicago? I don't want to fight you, Captain. We want to catch him and go home. What do you want?"
Osborne moved a couple of items on his desk, a pen holder, a picture of a fox-faced child in band uniform. He leaned back in his chair, pursed his lips, and blew out some air.
"Right now, I want some coffee. You guys want some?"
"I'd like some," Crawford said.
"So would I," Graham said.
Osborne passed around the styrofoam cups. He pointed to some chairs. "The Tooth Fairy had to have a van or a panel truck to move Lowndes around in that wheelchair," Graham said.
Osborne nodded. "The license plate Lowndes saw was stolen off a TV repair truck in Oak Park. He took a commercial plate, so he was getting it for a truck or a van. He replaced the plate on the TV truck with another stolen plate so it wouldn't be noticed so fast. Very sly, this boy. One thing we do know. He got the plate off the TV truck sometime after 8:30 yesterday morning. The TV repair guy bought gas first thing yesterday, and he used a credit card. The attendant copied the correct license number on the slip, so the plate was stolen after that."
"Nobody saw any kind of truck or van?" Crawford said.
"Nothing. The guard at the Tatler saw Zip. He could referee wrestling, he sees so little. The fire department responded first to the Tatler. They were just looking for fire.
We're canvassing the overnight workers in the Tatler neighborhood, and the neighborhood's where the TV guy worked Tuesday morning. We hope somebody saw him cop the plate.
I'd like to see the chair again, Graham said. It's in our lab. I'll call him for you. Osborne paused.
Lowndes was a ballsy little guy. You have to give him that. Remembering the license number and spitting it out, the shape he was in.
You listened to what Lowndes said at the hospital?
Graham nodded. I don't mean to rub this in, but I want to know if we heard it the same way. What does it sound like to you?
Graham quoted in a monotone. Tooth fairy. Graham set me up. The cunt knew it. Graham set me up. Cunt put his hand on me in the picture like a fucking pet.
Osborne could not tell how Graham felt about it. He asked another question.
He was talking about the picture of you and him in the Tatler?
Had to be.
Where would he get that idea?
Lowndes and I had a few run-ins.
But you looked friendly toward Lowndes in the picture. The tooth fairy kills the pet first. Is that it?
That's it.
The stone fox was pretty fast, Graham thought.
Too bad you didn't stake him out.
Graham said nothing.
Lowndes was supposed to be with us by the time the tooth fairy saw the Tatler, Crawford said.
Does what he said mean anything else to you? Anything we can use?
Graham came back from somewhere and had to repeat Osborne's question in his mind before he answered.
We know from what Lowndes said that the tooth fairy saw the Tatler before he hit Lowndes, right?
Right.
If you start with the idea that the Tatler set him off, does it strike you that he set this up in a hell of a hurry? The thing came off the press Monday night. He's in Chicago stealing license plates sometime Tuesday, probably Tuesday morning, and he's on top of Lowndes Tuesday afternoon. What does that say to you?
That he saw it early, or he didn't have far to come, Crawford said. Either he saw it here in Chicago, or he saw it someplace else Monday night. Now bear in mind, he'd be watching for it to get the personal column.
Either he was already here, or he came from driving distance, Graham said. He was on top of Lowndes too fast, with a big old wheelchair you couldn't carry on a plane. It doesn't even fold. And he didn't fly here, steal a van, steal plates for it, and go around looking for an antique wheelchair to use. He had to have an old wheelchair. A new one wouldn't work for what he did.
Graham was up, fiddling with the cord on the Venetian blinds, staring at the brick wall across the air shaft. He already had the wheelchair, or he saw it all the time.
Osborne started to ask a question, but Crawford's expression cautioned him to wait.
Graham was tying knots in the blind cord. His hands were not steady.
"He saw it all the time," Crawford prompted.
"Uh-huh," Graham said.
You can see how the idea starts with the wheelchair. From the sight and thought of the wheelchair, that's where the idea would come from when he's thinking what he'll do to those fuckers. Freddy rolling down the street on fire. It must have been quite a sight.
Do you think he watched it?
Maybe. He certainly saw it before he did it, when he was making up his mind what he'd do.
Osborne watched Crawford. Crawford was solid. Osborne knew Crawford was solid. And Crawford was going along with this.
If he had the chair, or he saw it all the time, we can check around the nursing homes, the VA, Osborne said.
It was perfect to hold Freddy still, Graham said.
For a long time. He was gone 15 hours and 25 minutes, more or less. Osborne said.
If he had just wanted to snuff Freddy, he could have done that in the garage, Graham said. He could have burned him in his car. He wanted to talk to Freddy, or hurt him for a while.
Either he did it in the back of the van, or he took him somewhere, Crawford said.
That length of time, I'd say he took him somewhere. It had to be somewhere safe. If he bundled him up good, he wouldn't attract much notice around a nursing home going in and out, Osborne said. He'd have the racket, though, Crawford said. A certain amount of cleaning up to do. Assume he had the chair, and he had access to the van, and he had a safe place to take him to work on him. Does that sound like home? Osborne's telephone rang. He growled into it.
What? No, I don't want to talk to the tattler. Well, it better not be bullshit. Put her on. Captain Osborne, yes?
What time? Who answered the phone initially, at the switchboard?
Take her off the switchboard, please.
Tell me again what he said.
I'll have an officer there in 5 minutes.
Osborne looked at his telephone thoughtfully after he hung up. Lounge secretary got a call about 5 minutes ago, he said. She swears it was Lounge's voice. He said something she didn't get. Strength of the great red dragon. That's what she thought, he said.
Chapter 24. Dr. Frederick Chilton stood in the corridor outside Hannibal Lecter's cell. With Chilton, there were three large orderlies. One carried a straitjacket and leg restraints, and another held a can of mace. The third loaded a tranquilizer dart into his air rifle. Lecter was reading an actuarial chart at his table and taking notes. He had heard the footsteps coming. He heard the rifle breech close behind him, but he continued to read and gave no sign that he knew Chilton was there. Chilton had sent him the newspapers at noon and let him wait until night to find out his punishment for helping the dragon.
Dr. Lecter, Chilton said.
Lecter turned around.
Good evening, Dr. Chilton.
He didn't acknowledge the presence of the guards. He looked only at Chilton.
I've come for your books.
All your books.
I see.
May I ask how long you intend to keep them?
That depends on your attitude.
Is this your decision?
I decide the punitive measures here.
Of course you do. It's not the sort of thing Will Graham would request.
Back up to the net and slip these on, Dr. Lecter. I won't ask you twice.
Certainly, Dr. Chilton. I hope that's a 39. The 37's a snug around the chest.
Dr. Lecter put on the restraints as though they were dinner clothes. An orderly reached through the barrier and fastened them from the back.
Help him to his cot, Chilton said.
While the orderlies stripped the bookshelves, Chilton polished his glasses and stirred Lecter's personal papers with a pen. Lecter watched from the shadowed corner of his cell. There was a curious grace about him, even in restraints.
Beneath the yellow folder, Lecter said quietly, you'll find a rejection slip the archives sent you. It was brought to me by mistake with some of my archives mail, and I'm afraid I opened it without looking at the envelope. Sorry.
Chilton reddened. He spoke to an orderly.
I think you'd better take the seat off Dr. Lecter's toilet.
Chilton looked at the actuarial table. Lecter had written his age at the top, 41.
And what do you have here? Chilton asked.
Time,
Dr. Lecter said.
Section Chief Brian Zeller took the courier's case and the wheelchair wheels into instrumental analysis, walking at a rate that made his gabardine pants whistle. The staff, held over from the day shift, knew that whistling sound very well. Zeller, in a hurry. There had been enough delays. The weary courier, his flight from Chicago delayed by weather, and then diverted to Philadelphia, had rented a car and driven down to the FBI laboratory in Washington. The Chicago Police Laboratory is efficient, but there are things it is not equipped to do. Zeller prepared to do them now. At the mass spectrometer, he dropped off the paint flecks from Lowndes' car door.
Beverly Katz and Hair and Fiber got the wheels to share with others in the section. Zeller's last stop was the small hot room, where Liza Lake bent over her gas chromatograph. She was testing ashes from a Florida arson case, watching the stylus trace its spiky line on the moving graph. "Ace lighter fluid," she said. "That's what he lit it with." She had looked at so many samples that she could distinguish brands without searching through the manual. Zeller took his eyes off Liza Lake and rebuked himself severely for feeling pleasure in the office. He cleared his throat and held up the two shiny paint cans. "Chicago?" she said. Zeller nodded. She checked the condition of the cans and the seal of the lids. One can contained ashes from the wheelchair, the other charred material from Lowndes. "How long has it been in the cans?"
6 hours, anyway," Zeller said.
"I'll headspace it." She pierced the lid with a heavy-duty syringe, extracted air that had been confined with the ashes, and injected the air directly into the gas chromatograph. She made minute adjustments. As the sample moved along the machine's 500-foot column, the stylus jiggled on the wide graph paper.
"Unleaded," she said.
"It's gasohol. Unleaded gasohol.
Don't see much of that."
She flipped quickly through a loose-leaf file of sample graphs. "I can't give you a brand yet. Let me do it with pentane, and I'll get back to you."
"Good," Zeller said.
Pentane would dissolve the fluid in the ashes, then fractionate early in the chromatograph, leaving the fluids for fine analysis. By 1 a.m., Zeller had all he could get. Liza Lake succeeded in naming the gasohol. Freddie Lowndes was burned with a Servco Supreme blend. Patient brushing in the grooves of the wheelchair treads yielded two kinds of carpet fiber, wool and synthetic. Mold in dirt from the treads indicated the chair had been stored in a cool, dark place. The other results were less satisfactory. The paint flecks were not original factory paint. Blasted in the mass spectrometer and compared with the National Automotive Paint File, the paint proved to be high-quality Duco enamel manufactured in a lot of 186,000 gallons during the first quarter of 1978 for sale to several auto paint shop chains. Zeller had hoped to pinpoint a make of vehicle and the approximate time of manufacture. He telexed the results to Chicago. The Chicago Police Department wanted its wheels back. The wheels made an awkward package for the courier. Zeller put written lab reports in his pouch along with mail and a package that had come for Graham.
"Federal Express, I'm not," the courier said when he was sure Zeller couldn't hear him.
The Justice Department maintains several small apartments near 7th District Court in Chicago for the use of jurists and favored expert witnesses when court is in session. Graham stayed in one of these, with Crawford across the hall. He came in at 9 p.m., tired and wet. He had not eaten since breakfast on the plane from Washington, and the thought of food repelled him. Rainy Wednesday was over at last. It was as bad a day as he could remember. With Lowndes dead, it seemed likely that he was next, and all day Chester had watched his back while he was in Lowndes' garage, while he stood in the rain on the scorched pavement where Lowndes was burned. With strobe lights flashing in his face, he told the press he was grieved at the loss of his friend Frederick Lowndes. He was going to the funeral, too. So were a number of federal agents and police, in the hope that the killer would come to see Graham grieve. Actually, he felt nothing he could name, just cold nausea and an occasional wave of sickly exhilaration that he had not burned to death instead of Lowndes. It seemed to Graham that he had learned nothing in 40 years. He had just gotten tired. He made a big martini and drank it while he undressed. He had another after his shower while he watched the news.
An FBI trap to catch the Tooth Fairy backfires, and a veteran reporter is dead. We'll be back with details on Eyewitness News after this. They were referring to the killer as the Dragon before the newscast was over. The Tattler had spilled it all to the networks. Graham wasn't surprised. Thursday's edition should sell well. He made a third martini and called Molly. She had seen the television news at 6 and 10 o'clock, and she had seen a Tattler. She knew that Graham had been the bait in a trap. "You should have told me, Will." "Maybe. I don't think so." "Will he try to kill you now?" "Sooner or later. It would be hard for him now since I'm moving around. I'm covered all the time, Molly, and he knows it. I'll be okay." "You sound a little slurry. Have you been to see your friend in the fridge?"
"I had a couple."
"How do you feel?"
"Fairly rotten."
The news said the FBI didn't have any protection for the reporter. He was supposed to be with Crawford by the time the Tooth Fairy got the paper. The news is calling him the Dragon now.
That's what he calls himself.
"Will, there's something... I want to take Willie and leave here."
"And go where?"
"His grandparents. They haven't seen him in a while. They'd like to see him."
"Oh, uh-huh."
Willie's father's parents had a ranch on the Oregon coast. "It's creepy here. I know it's supposed to be safe, but we're not sleeping a whole lot. Maybe the shooting lessons spooked me. I don't know."
"I'm sorry, Molly. I wish I could tell you how sorry."
"I'll miss you. We both will."
So, she had made up her mind.
"When are you going?"
"In the morning."
"What about the shop?" "Evelyn wants to take it. I'll underwrite the fall stuff with the wholesalers, just for the interest, and she can keep what she makes."
"The dogs?"
"I asked her to call the county, Will. I'm sorry, but maybe somebody will take some of them."
"Molly,
if staying here, I could keep something bad from happening to you, I'd stay. But you can't save anybody, Will. I'm not helping you here. With us up there, you can just think about taking care of yourself. I'm not carrying this damned pistol the rest of my life, Will."
"Maybe you can get down to Oakland and watch the A's."
"Didn't mean to say that."
"Oh, boy. This silence is getting pretty long."
"Well, look, I'll call you," she said. "Or I guess you'll have to call me up there." Graham felt something tearing. He felt short of breath. "Let me get the office to make the arrangements. Have you made a reservation already?" "I didn't use my name. I thought maybe the newspapers..."
"Good. Good.
Let me get somebody to see you off. You wouldn't have to board through the gate, and you'd get out of Washington absolutely clean. Can I do that?" "Let me do that. What time does the plane go?"
9:40, American 118.
"Okay. 8:30, behind the Smithsonian. There's a park right. Leave the car there. Somebody'll meet you. He'll listen to his watch, put it to his ear when he gets out of his car, okay?" "That's fine."
"Say, do you change at O'Hare? I could come out."
"No, change in Minneapolis."
"Oh, Molly. Maybe I could come up there and get you when it's over."
"That would be very nice."
"Very nice. Do you have enough money?"
"The bank's wiring me some."
"What?"
"To Barclays at the airport."
"Don't worry. I'll miss you."
"Me too. But that'll be the same as now. Same distance by phone. Willie says hi."
"Hi to Willie."
"Be careful, darling." She had never called him darling before. He didn't care for it. He didn't care for new names. Darling, Red Dragon. The night duty officer in Washington was glad to make the arrangements for Molly. Graham pressed his face to the cool window and watched sheets of rain whip over the muffled traffic below him, the street leaping from gray to sudden color in the lightning flashes.
His face left a print of forehead, nose, lips, and chin on the glass. Molly was gone. The day was over, and there was only the night to face, and the lipless voice accusing him. Lown's woman held what was left of his hand until it was over. "Hello, this is Valerie Leeds. I'm sorry I can't come to the phone right now."
"I'm sorry, too," Graham said.
Graham filled his glass again and sat at the table by the window, staring at the empty chair across from him. He stared until the space in the opposite chair assumed a man shape, filled with dark and swarming motes, a presence like a shadow on suspended dust. He tried to make the image coalesce, to see a face. It would not move, had no countenance, but faceless, faced him with palpable attention.
"I know it's tough," Graham said. He was intensely drunk. "You've got to try to stop. Just hold off until we find you. If you got to do something, fuck, come after me. I don't give a shit. It'll be better after that. They've got some things now to help you make it stop. To help you stop wanting to so bad. Help me. Help me a little. Molly's gone. Old Freddy's dead. It's you and me now, sport."
He leaned across the table, his hand extended to touch, and the presence was gone. Graham put his head down on the table, his cheek on his arm. He could see the print of his forehead, nose, mouth, and chin on the window as the lightning flashed behind it, a face with drops crawling through it down the glass, eyeless, a face full of rain. Graham had tried hard to understand the dragon. At times, in the breathing silence of the victims' houses, the very spaces the dragon had moved through tried to speak. Sometimes Graham felt close to him. A feeling he remembered from other investigations had settled over him in recent days. The taunting sense that he and the dragon were doing the same things at various times of the day, that there were parallels in the quotidian details of their lives. Somewhere the dragon was eating, or showering, or sleeping, at the same time he did. Graham tried hard to know him. He tried to see him past the blinding glint of slides and vials, beneath the lines of police reports, tried to see his face through the louvers of print. He tried as hard as he knew how. But to begin to understand the dragon, to hear the cold drips in his darkness, to watch the world through his red haze, Graham would have had to see things he could never see. And he would have had to fly through time.
Chapter 25. Springfield, Missouri, June 14th, 1938. Marion Dollarhide Trevane, tired and in pain, got out of a taxi at City Hospital. Hot wind whipped grit against her ankles as she climbed the steps. The suitcase she lugged was better than her loose wash dress, and so was the mesh evening bag she pressed to her swollen belly. She had 2 quarters and a dime in her bag. She had Francis Dollarhide in her belly. She told the admitting officer her name was Betty Johnson, a lie. She said her husband was a musician, but she did not know his whereabouts, which was true. They put her in the charity section of the maternity ward. She did not look at the patients on either side of her. She looked across the aisle at the soles of feet. In 4 hours, she was taken to the delivery room, where Francis Dollarhide was born. The obstetrician remarked that he looked more like a leaf-nosed bat than a baby, another truth. He was born with bilateral fissures in his upper lip and in his hard and soft palates. The center section of his mouth was unanchored and protruded. His nose was flat. The hospital supervisors decided not to show him to his mother immediately.
They waited to see if the infant could survive without oxygen. They put him in a bed at the rear of the infant ward and faced him away from the viewing window. He could breathe, but he could not feed. With his palate cleft, he could not suck. His crying on the first day was not as continuous as that of a heroin-addicted baby, but it was as piercing. By the afternoon of the second day, a thin keening was all he could produce. When the shifts changed at 3 p.m., a wide shadow fell across his bed. Prince Easter Mize, 260 pounds, cleaning woman and aide in the maternity ward, stood looking at him, her arms folded on top of her bosom. In 26 years in the nursery, she had seen about 39,000 infants. This one would live if he ate. Prince Easter had received no instructions from the Lord about letting this infant die. She doubted that the hospital had received any either. She took from her pocket a rubber stopper pierced with a curved glass drinking straw. She pushed the stopper into a bottle of milk. She could hold the baby and support his head in one great hand. She held him to her breast until she knew he felt her heartbeat. Then she flipped him over and popped the tube down his throat. He took about 2 ounces and went to sleep. "Uh-huh," she said. She put him down and went about her assigned duties with the diaper pails. On the fourth day, the nurses moved Marion Dollarhide Trevane to a private room. Hollyhocks left over from a previous occupant were in an enamel pitcher on the washstand. They had held up pretty well. Marion was a handsome girl, and the puffiness was leaving her face. She looked at the doctor when he started talking to her, his hand on her shoulder. She could smell strong soap on his hand, and she thought about the crinkles at the corners of his eyes until she realized what he was saying. Then she closed her eyes and did not open them while they brought the baby in. Finally, she looked. They shut the door when she screamed. Then they gave her a shot. On the fifth day, she left the hospital alone. She didn't know where to go. She could never go home again. Her mother had made that clear. Marion Dollarhide Trevane counted the steps between the light poles. Each time she passed 3 poles, she sat on the suitcase to rest. At least she had the suitcase. In every town there was a pawn shop near the bus station. She had learned that traveling with her husband. Springfield in 1938 was not a center for plastic surgery. In Springfield, you wore your face as it was. A surgeon at City Hospital did the best he could for Francis Dollarhide, first retracting the front section of his mouth with an elastic band, then closing the clefts in his lip by a rectangular flap technique that is now outmoded. The cosmetic results were not good. The surgeon had trouble to read up on the problem and decided correctly that repair of the infant's hard palate should wait until he was 5. To operate sooner would distort the growth of his face. A local dentist volunteered to make an obturator, which plugged the baby's palate and permitted him to feed without flooding his nose. The infant went to the Springfield Foundling Home for 1.5 years, and then to Morgan Lee Memorial Orphanage. Reverend S.B. Buddy Lomax was head of the orphanage. Brother Buddy called the other boys and girls together and told them that Francis was a hare lip, but they must be careful never to call him a hare lip. Brother Buddy suggested they pray for him. Francis Dollarhide's mother learned to take care of herself in the years following his birth. Marion Dollarhide first found a job typing in the office of a ward boss in the St. Louis Democratic machine. With his help, she had her marriage to the absent Mr. Trevane annulled. There was no mention of a child in the annulment proceedings. She had nothing to do with her mother. "I didn't raise you to slut for that Irish trash," were Mrs. Dollarhide's parting words to Marion when she left home with Trevain. Marion's ex-husband called her once at the office. Sober and pious, he told her he had been saved and wanted to know if he, Marion, and the child he never had the joy of knowing might make a new life together. He sounded broke. Marion told him the child was born dead, and she hung up. He showed up drunk at her boarding house with his suitcase. When she told him to go away, he observed that it was her fault the marriage failed, and the child was stillborn. He expressed doubt that the child was his. In a rage, Marion Dollarhide told Michael Trevain exactly what he had fathered, and told him he was welcome to it. She reminded him that there were two cleft palates in the Trevain family. She put him in the street and told him never to call her again. He didn't. But years later, drunk and brooding over Marion's rich new husband and her fine life, he did call Marion's mother. He told Mrs. Dollarhide about the deformed child and said her snag teeth proved the hereditary fault lay with the Dollarhides. A week later, a Kansas City streetcar cut Michael Trevain in two. When Trevain told Mrs. Dollarhide that Marion had a hidden son, she sat up most of the night. Tall and lean in her rocker, Grandmother Dollarhide stared into the fire. Toward dawn, she began a slow and purposeful rocking. Somewhere upstairs in the big house, a cracked voice called out of sleep. The floor above Grandmother Dollarhide creaked as someone shuffled toward the bathroom. A heavy thump on the ceiling, someone falling, and the cracked voice called in pain. Grandmother Dollarhide never took her eyes off the fire. She rocked faster, and, in time, the calling stopped. Near the end of his fifth year, Francis Dollarhide had his first and only visitor at the orphanage. He was sitting in the thick reek of the cafeteria when an older boy came for him and took him to Brother Buddy's office. The lady waiting with Brother Buddy was tall and middle-aged, dredged in powder, her hair in a tight bun. Her face was stark white. There were touches of yellow in the gray hair and in the eyes and teeth. What struck Francis, what he would always remember, she smiled with pleasure when she saw his face. That had never happened before her. No one would ever do it again. "This is your grandmother," Brother Buddy said. "Hello," she said. Brother Buddy wiped his own mouth with a long hand. "Say hello. Go ahead." Francis had learned to say some things by occluding his nostrils with his upper lip, but he did not have much occasion for hello. "Lo," was the best he could do. Grandmother seemed even more pleased with him. "Can you say grandmother?"
"Try to say grandmother," Brother Buddy said.
The plosive G defeated him. Francis strangled easily on tears. A red wasp buzzed and tapped against the ceiling. "Never mind," his grandmother said. "I'll just bet you can say your name. I just know a big boy like you can say his name. Say it for me." The child's face brightened. The big boys had helped him with this. He wanted to please. He collected himself. "Cunt face," he said. 3 days later, Grandmother Dollarhide called for Francis at the orphanage and took him home with her. She began at once to help him with his speech. They concentrated on a single word. It was mother. Within 2 years of the annulment, Marion Dollarhide met and married Howard Vogt, a successful lawyer with solid connections to the St. Louis machine and what was left of the old Pendergast machine in Kansas City. Vogt was a widower with three young children, an affable, ambitious man 15 years older than Marion Dollarhide. He hated nothing in the world except the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, which had singed his feathers in the voter registration scandal of 1936 and blasted the attempt in 1940 by the St. Louis machine to steal the governorship. By 1943, Volk's star was rising again. He was a brewery candidate for the state legislature and was mentioned as a possible delegate to the upcoming state constitutional convention. Marion was a useful and attractive hostess, and Vogt bought her a handsome, half-timbered house on Olive Street that was perfect for entertaining. Francis Dollarhide had lived with his grandmother for a week when she took him there. Grandmother had never seen her daughter's house. The maid who answered the door did not know her. "I'm Mrs. Dollarhide," she said, barging past the servant. Her slip was showing 3 inches in the back. She led Francis into a big living room with a pleasant fire. "Who is it, Viola?" a woman's voice from upstairs. Grandmother cupped Francis's face in her hand. He could smell the cold leather glove. An urgent whisper. "Go see Mother, Francis. Go see Mother. Run!" He shrank from her, twisting on the tines of her eyes. "Go see Mother. Run!" She gripped his shoulders and marched him toward the stairs. He trotted up to the landing and looked back down at her. She motioned upward with her chin. Up to the strange hallway toward the open bedroom door, Mother was seated at her dressing table, checking her makeup in a mirror framed with lights. She was getting ready for a political rally, and too much rouge wouldn't do. Her back was to the door.
"Mother,"
Francis piped, as he had been taught. He tried hard to get it right.
"Mother."
She saw him in the mirror then. "If you're looking for Ned, he isn't home from..."
"Mother."
He came into the heartless light. Marion heard her mother's voice downstairs, demanding tea. Her eyes widened, and she sat very still. She did not turn around. She turned out the makeup lights and vanished from the mirror. In the darkened room, she gave a single, low keening that ended in a sob. It might have been for herself, or it might have been for him. Grandmother took Francis to all the political rallies after that and explained who he was and where he came from. She had him say hello to everyone. They did not work on hello at home. Mr. Vogt lost the election by 1,800 votes. Chapter 26. At Grandmother's house, Francis Dollarhide's new world was a forest of blue-veined legs. Grandmother Dollarhide had been running her nursing home for 3 years when he came to live with her. Money had been a problem since her husband's death in 1936. She had been brought up a lady, and she had no marketable skills. What she had was a big house and her late husband's debts. Taking in boarders was out. The place was too isolated to be a successful boarding house. She was threatened with eviction. The announcement in the newspaper of Marion's marriage to the affluent Mr. Howard Vogt had seemed a godsend to Grandmother. She wrote to Marion repeatedly for help, but received no answer. Every time she telephoned, a servant told her Mrs. Vogt was out. Finally, bitterly, Grandmother Dollarhide made an arrangement with the county and began to take in elderly, indigent persons. For each one, she received a sum from the county and erratic payments from such relatives as the county could locate. It was hard until she began to get some private patients from middle-class families. No help from Marion all this time, and Marion could have helped. Now Francis Dollarhide played on the floor in the forest of legs. He played cards with Grandmother's mahjong pieces, pushing them among feet twisted like gnarled roots. Mrs. Dollarhide could keep clean washed dresses on her residence, but she despaired at trying to make them keep on their shoes. The old people sat all day in the living room listening to the radio. Mrs. Dollarhide had put in a small aquarium for them to watch as well, and a private contributor had helped her cover her parquet floors with linoleum against the inevitable incontinence. They sat in a row on the couches and in wheelchairs, listening to the radio, their faded eyes fixed on the fish, or on nothing, or something they saw long ago. Frances would always remember the shuffle of feet on linoleum in the hot and buzzing day, and the smell of stewed tomatoes and cabbage from the kitchen. The smell of the old people, like meat wrappers dried in the sun, and always the radio. Rinso white, rinso bright, happy little wash day song. Frances spent as much time as he could in the kitchen because his friend was there. The cook, Queen Mother Bailey, had grown up in the service of the late Mr. Dollarhide's family. She sometimes brought Frances a plum in her apron pocket, and she called him Little Possum, always dreamin'. The kitchen was warm and safe, but Queen Mother Bailey went home at night. December, 1943. Frances Dollarhide, 5 years old, lay in bed in his upstairs room in grandmother's house. The room was pitch dark, with its blackout curtains against the Japanese. He could not say Japanese. He needed to pee. He was afraid to get up in the dark. He called to his grandmother in bed downstairs.
Emma! Emma!
He sounded like an infant goat. He called until he was tired.
Please, Emma.
It got away from him then, hot on his legs and under his seat, and then cold, his nightdress sticking to him. He didn't know what to do. He took a deep breath and rolled over to face the door. Nothing happened to him. He put his foot on the floor. He stood up in the dark, nightdress plastered to his legs, face burning. He ran for the door. The doorknob caught him over the eye, and he sat down in wetness, jumped up, and ran down the stairs, fingers squealing on the banister. To his grandmother's room. Crawling across her in the dark and under the covers, warm against her now. Grandmother stirred, tensed. Her back hardened against his cheek, voice hissing.
I've never cheated.
A clatter on the bedside table as she found her teeth. Clacket as she put them in.
I've never seen a child as disgusting and dirty as you. Get out. Get out of this bed.
She turned on the bedside lamp. He stood on the carpet shivering. She wiped her thumb across his eyebrow. Her thumb came away bloody.
Did you break something?
He shook his head so fast, droplets of blood fell on grandmother's nightgown.
Upstairs. Go on.
The dark came down over him as he climbed the stairs. He couldn't turn on the lights because grandmother had cut the cords off short so only she could reach them. He did not want to get back in the wet bed. He stood in the dark, holding on to the footboard for a long time. He thought she wasn't coming. The blackest corners in the room knew she wasn't coming. She came, snatching the short cord on the ceiling light, her arms full of sheets. She did not speak to him as she changed the bed. She gripped his upper arm and pulled him down the hall to the bathroom. The light was over the mirror, and she had to stand on tiptoe to reach it. She gave him a washcloth, wet and cold.
Take off your nightshirt and wipe yourself off.
Smell of adhesive tape and the bright sewing scissors clicking. She snipped out a butterfly of tape, stood him on the toilet lid, and closed the cut over his eye.
Now, she said.
She held the sewing scissors under his round belly, and he felt cold down there.
Look, she said.
She grabbed the back of his head and bent him over to see his little penis lying across the bottom blade of the open scissors. She closed the scissors until they began to pinch him. "Do you want me to cut it off?" He tried to look up at her, but she gripped his head. He sobbed, and spit fell on his stomach. "Do you?"
"No, Emma. No, Emma."
"I pledge you my word, if you ever make your bed dirty again, I'll cut it off. Do you understand?"
"Yeah, Emma."
"You can find the toilet in the dark, and you can sit on it like a good boy. You don't have to stand up. Now go back to bed." At 2 a.m., the wind rose, gusting warm out of the southeast, clacking together the branches of the dead apple trees, rustling the leaves of the live ones. The wind drove warm rain against the side of the house, where Francis Dollarhide, 42 years old, lay sleeping. He lay on his side, sucking his thumb, his hair damp and flat on his forehead and his neck. Now he awakes. He listens to his breathing in the dark.